From the Sky News Centre at 5, five people found guilty of killing a vulnerable man who was beaten to death have been sentenced to a total of at least 55 years in jail. Asperger's sufferer Sean Rossington was lured to Grassland in Lincoln, where he was kicked, cut and stamped on in June last year. Four of the group were convicted of the 21-year-old's murder. One was jailed for manslaughter. Sean's mother, Sharon Rossington, can't believe what's happened to her son.
The emotions often that I struggle with is the knowledge of what he suffered, his injuries that became apparent from the pathology reports. Horrific.
The Egyptian military is on the streets of Cairo trying to deal with the escalating violent clashes. Anti-government protesters are reported to have set fire to the ruling party's headquarters, and there have been several loud explosions. Unions are warning that workers face a volatile cocktail of job cuts and attacks on pay. At a meeting to determine how to combat government austerity measures, the TUC announced a mass day of demonstration. It will take place on March the 26th. The former apprentice candidate Christopher Farrell says he deeply regrets fraudulently processing mortgage applications. The 29-year-old from the Wirral has been given a suspended 9-month jail sentence for faking documents for his customers. It helped them secure finance beyond their means. His former boss, Tricia Kennedy, says she had no idea what Farrell was doing behind the scenes.
30 years of building up a company and a good reputation, and I just couldn't believe that somebody could do that. So, yeah, shocked.
Sport and Andy Murray's just one victory away from creating a piece of tennis history. He's aiming to become the first British man to win a Grand Slam tournament for 75 years on Sunday. The world number five faces Novak Djokovic in the Australian Open final. And three greyhounds who made history in an unprecedented triple dead heat stage a rematch tonight. Iams the Girl, Drupis Djokovic and Kilishan Masai couldn't be separated during a race at Romford earlier this month. The odds on that were said to be several million to one. From Sky, I'm Ursula Hansford.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Are you a woman or know a woman who's made a difference in our community? The Women Who Make a Difference Awards 2011 are in recognition of the valuable contributions women are making to improving and sustaining our community. It could be any woman who's inspired you, been a role model, or made a difference in your life. The awards ceremony will be part of the International Women's Day celebrations in Bristol. For more information and an application form, contact Fiona Watson on 922 2329 or email fiona.watson@bristol.gov.uk. All nominations must be received by Monday the 7th of February. These awards are run by Bristol City Council and the Bristol Women's Forum. Women Who Make a Difference Awards 2011. Women Who Make a Difference Awards 2011. Promoting women's equality.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello Bristol and welcome to Friday Drive Time, BCFM's politics show. I'm Tony Gosling and I'm joined this week by Labour councillor for Southmead, Jenny Smith. Now Jenny was in a couple of weeks ago but she only got 10 minutes so we thought we'd give her another go. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, are you fed up with the price of homes? We hear about a new initiative supported by the council to provide cheap or even free sites for self-build and self-finish housing across the city. Plus, the privatisation of the National Health Service. Who's really behind Andrew Lansley's changes? A truly frightening report from Spinwatch. And the first part of our series on censorship. We go back to 1987 and the day the lights went out at the BBC. That's in the second hour. On to our review of this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 3 degrees, that's actually minus 3 degrees, but staying dry. So no snow, but frost. Highs tomorrow only 2 degrees Celsius, and sunny, but feeling cold over the weekend. Next week, highs of 10 Celsius, and that's a sunny week, but the beginning of the week will be feeling particularly cold, as will the weekend, clearly. Right, and next weekend, 5th and 6th of February, up a little bit, up highs to 9 degrees Celsius, sunny on Saturday, rainy on Sunday. So it sounds like next Saturday is the best bet if you want to go out. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and with me is Labour councillor for South Mead, Jenny Smith. Hi, Jenny, and welcome to Drive Time.
Right, thank you.
Let's see if we can manage a whole hour this time. Can you tell us, first of all, what brought you into politics, first of all?
I was born into politics. My father came out with the general strike and walked 65 miles to get a job. My mother and my grandmother went to Pankhurst sewing classes in the East End of London. I grew up with politics, and I grew up with some very, very brainy people, none of which had academic qualifications.
So were you, even as a youngster, the sort of the future of the country, the various issues around were being discussed daily, were they at home?
Yes. We always divided the paper up. People had different pages at breakfast, and then you put down the paper and we discussed the world. My husband, when he married me, thought he'd sort it out. He didn't.
So why the Labour Party then? Why not one of the other political parties?
Because the Labour Party cares about ordinary people. It has principles which are based on ethics that I would support. It's probably, somebody would say it's a bit romantic, but it isn't. It's about allowing people to achieve things in their own right, about giving decent homes, decent jobs, protection at those jobs. It's the environment. It's all sorts of issues that I would contribute to, and I hope some of your listeners will as well.
So is it also about conducting illegal invasions against Iraq, which happened under Tony Blair's leadership?
No, it's not, and I'm the one that was a cabinet member that stopped being a cabinet member because I was all over the Evening Post and Radio Bristol actually saying I thought it was a silly thing to go to war. And I've been proved right. But you don't walk around telling everyone, I told you so. You wait until they work that out themselves.
So it sounds to me like there's something wrong maybe then with the Labour Party, that the leadership aren't really listening to the membership.
Well, I think it was a rushed job. It was also based on misinformation. I've always been brought up to think that anybody who's a spy actually likes to get paid, so they will invent things if it's not true. So how are you going to actually audit what spies bring in, no matter where they are in the world? Because it's all about earning their living.
Now, you served on the cabinet on Bristol City Council, I think some 8-9 years ago, maybe not quite so long.
I was chair of social services after Arthur Keith went, and then I was the cabinet member for social services, and then went over to become the cabinet member of social responsibility.
Well, it doesn't sound like you've done a very good job, because the people have voted the Liberal Democrats in instead, and they voted out the Labour Party in the city.
They didn't in my ward. I think people know where I'm coming from. But also, as far as I'm concerned, people believe a lot of things they shouldn't. They should go and check the facts. They should read things. They should be a bit like me, perhaps not as much, but actually read everything inside. I'm a readaholic, and I listen to the news, I listen to the world, because what happens abroad affects our economy, us, and our day-to-day lives just as much as anything else. So I would say to anybody, go and do what I did. I left school at 14 and a half with no qualifications. I went to Bristol South. I took O-levels and A-levels. I went off to UWE and got professional qualifications. And then after 15 years of working for Shelter, I actually went and got a degree at UWE again. And since then, yes, I go to Warwick University for training. I've got certificates coming out of my ears. But those are, as far as I'm concerned, certificates that I have achieved to hand back to the people of this city, because the more knowledge I have, the more I can open the doors for them to be able to find that knowledge as well.
So, but what would you say to people who think, well, we'd like to vote for Jenny, but actually, by voting for Labour, we're not going to actually get Jenny's type of politics happening in the city?
Yes, I'm not alone. I couldn't stay there if I was alone. Get to know us as people, and we've got a really good bunch coming up this time. We've got people that have come forward for all the right reasons, so I would say to them, vote for them and give me back what I used to have, which was a team.
And what would you say to, also, there's many times we hear, particularly on the Vox Pops we do out on the streets here, that people say, well, actually all the main parties, they all kind of do the same, really.
No, we don't. We're completely different, and we proved it. This government have proved beyond any doubt that we are not the same as the Tories or the Liberal Democrats, that we valued education, that we worried about people and put training on for the unemployed. We treasured the National Health Service, which is on its way to being privatised now. And it's about respect for all the people in our communities. I mean, you were saying just now about housing. I'm really worried about housing because the new homelessness policy that local authorities can do is to actually give somebody a bed and breakfast for 2 years, regardless of how much the rent is, regardless of what condition it is like, and that is the way they will discharge their duties. Not give them a decent home, which is what they really should have if you're going to have the generations of children of the future actually being brought up in a good environment, like I had and you had, and a lot of the people out there, the older people. We had life chances. The next generation won't have them unless we all join to work towards that.
Now, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here, as usual. Martin, I was reading this week about anarcho-capitalism. This is an expression I've not heard anything about before. Could you explain what is it?
Well, I mean, anarchists don't believe in the state. So anarcho-capitalism, if you like, is a belief in a capitalist society without the state. And it's semi-influential in the United States, this philosophy. There's a particular novelist called Ayn Rand who was very, very influential. And Alan Greenspan, who used to run the Federal Reserve, was very influenced by Ayn Rand. There are some interesting ideas there, but I think to most British audiences, the idea that you can have capitalism without the state, or in other words, without any public control whatsoever, is frankly bonkers.
Is there any kind of connection at all with the sort of anarchists we've had on the show here, people who are doing squatting
they are what you might call the left wing of the anarchist movement, and they believe in no state but no capitalism either. It's in my view also incoherent, but in a different way.
Okay, well, let's go and have a look at some of this week's stories. We're going to start in Egypt, as we heard in the news there, and apparently we're also hearing at the moment that the President Mubarak's party headquarters is on fire as we speak. Fresh protests we heard last night, and a momentary article that appeared for a few minutes on the Daily Telegraph website and then disappeared. Fresh protests could leave Egypt on the brink of revolution. A fresh wave of mass protests could leave Egypt teetering on the brink on Friday after police warned the president they would soon lose control of the demonstrators demanding his overthrow. Now, this is actually, according to the Telegraph anyway, coming from the police, Martin.
Well, it's just it's a snapshot of what's actually happening, isn't it, in Egypt. I think it's fascinating that the US, actually, Joe Biden was interviewed the other day, who's the vice president, and he was saying that he continued to support Mubarak because one of the main beneficiaries of US aid, military aid in particular, is Egypt. Egypt, Israel and Colombia are the three biggest recipients of US military aid. So these policemen who are shooting down demonstrators this afternoon are shooting them down at US taxpayer expense. But you can be sure that the demonstrators know very well who's paying for the bullets.
So how's this all going to go over the weekend? Let's have your crystal ball.
It's impossible to say sitting here in the studio in Bristol, isn't it? It looks like you've got a generation there.
We've had big changes in Tunisia, for example.
Yeah. Well, that's what's obviously encouraged people in Egypt and elsewhere in the Arab world to stand up and make a stand. The Middle East is actually on a knife edge at the moment because there's just been a change of government in Lebanon, which is and the new government is, the Americans aren't happy with that government even though it was elected, and the ordinary people in the Middle East, including inside Palestine, have reached boiling point, and there's a real danger that the Israelis are going to start a war with Lebanon, for example, to try and stymie this movement. But I think that once in a generation, people realise that if you don't take the opportunity to change the system, you won't get a second chance.
So to what extent do you think these are going to be in any way a real revolution and real changes, or is it just going to be another bunch of crooks taking over?
No, what's very interesting is that the demonstrations seem to be led by young people who are educated with the support of the rest of the population. They've not raised any kind of sectarian slogans. I saw pictures of people praying in the street in Egypt, but I don't think it's a united movement of the whole society. It's not just religious people who are rebelling. They were saying that girls dressed in jeans and smoking cigarettes were demonstrating alongside women with chadors on, and everybody was on the same side, and that's very encouraging, I think.
What are your thoughts, Jenny, about what's going on over in the Middle East and Egypt particularly?
A democratically elected governments, that they actually have various parties that can actually voice the needs of the people, so that right across the board, not just the wealthy, but those less off will be represented. But what worries me is the big powers of the world have been known. I mean, came in with the support of the Americans, and if they interfere with this, I think it will be a very sad day, because we want to achieve a more equal world for everybody.
Well, American rhetoric has been, we want to have democracy in the Middle East. That's supposedly why we invaded Iraq. But as soon as people vote for people the Americans don't like, as they did in Palestine, or as they've done in Lebanon, then the Americans say, oh no, we can't have that, you're extremists. Now, I think that kind of rhetoric has got to stop. I don't think the Americans know how to stop being a military power. Interestingly enough, MI6 were named in these leaks recently as having set up a whole working with the Palestinian security forces to suppress Hamas. And I would say, as a British taxpayer, what are MI6 doing sticking their finger into this business? What mandate do they have?
Well, the obvious thing, Martin, is there are British interests here, and that's what they're there to do.
British interests to suppress the democratic aspirations of the Palestinian people. Now, if MI6 are seen to be suppressing the democratic interests of the Palestinian people, are people ready for the car bombs in Bristol from the other side? If we're going to stick our finger into their politics, maybe they're going to stick our finger into ours. And I don't think we want that, do we? I think we need to learn to mind our own business.
I mean, I'm worried about Papa Doc coming back.
Indeed.
And why
this is over in Haiti.
Democratically elected Prime Minister isn't allowed back.
Yes, that's Aristide was not allowed back because the Americans are trying to block him out. I mean, in Honduras this time last year, a democratic government was overthrown by the military with the support of the Obama administration. The US is still run by gangsters, and many people in the world are increasingly fed up with their attitude.
Well, most people, I think, Martin, would think that actually the US is not gangsters running things. It's actually a government that has really close interests in resources around the world, that it's trying to protect American access to those resources.
Yes, by using force against people's democratic aspirations. That's gangsterism.
Okay, right, we're on to our next international story, and I'm afraid I missed this one last week. This is last Thursday. Iceland's Landsbanki chiefs were arrested, says the prosecutor, and this is Agence France-Presse in Reykjavik. Two former heads of the collapsed Icelandic bank Landsbanki, including former chief executive, have been arrested in connection with a market manipulation probe, the prosecutor on the case said on Friday. Sigurjón Amarsson, the former head of the failed bank, and Ivar Gudjonsson, its former investment chief, were arrested on Thursday and went before a judge Friday afternoon. Special prosecutor Alafur Thor Haukesson, I think I did quite well with that lot, told Agence France-Presse. Now, Martin, this is pretty interesting, isn't it? Because we haven't up to date seen wholesale arrests of entire boards of banks, and that's happened in Iceland. Why is that?
Well, obviously, in a small country, it's easier to name the guilty parties and to identify them. And of course, the Icelanders have also refused to pay the debt, unlike the Irish, who are still being put on the hook. In the 1980s, during the savings and loan scandal in the United States, more than 1,000 top executives were sent to prison. Not very, very little of that has happened this time, even though there's clear evidence, for example, that Goldman Sachs were mis-selling some of the policies that they were selling to investors, policies which were designed to fail. We will not be sure that there is a clean-up going on in the banking system until we see some arrests and some people sent to prison. We're not seeing that, so we're not seeing a clean-up, are we?
Well, there have been arrests. It's just no prison sentences and trials yet.
Indeed.
What is the difference between the way that the Icelandic government has dealt with this crisis and, say, for example, the Irish? Because they're both kind of quite countries where the crisis is hitting them before it's hitting us, so it's interesting to look at them and see how
what the Icelanders said in a referendum in which 90% of people voted yes was that we are not going to take over the debts of the private banks, the private banking system, and of course that actually hits the city of London. because what that actually means is that basically the City of London will have to take, because they were the ones who actually lent the Icelanders the money, they are going to have to take the hit, which meant that the British taxpayer then had to step in and bail out the British banks. And of course, if you remember, at one stage Gordon Brown was threatening to send gunboats to Iceland to make them pay, but when 98% of the people have voted in a referendum not to pay, that's not going to work. And of course, lots of other countries are going to refuse to pay, all of which is going to hit the City of London. Has George Osborne penciled any money in to cover all of that? No.
So what you're saying basically is that it's the City of London that's taking the hit with the Icelandic banking crash, not the Icelandic people.
Yes, and of course the Icelanders, being a small country, were able to get away with that. But bigger countries, Ireland first, possibly Spain, possibly Portugal, possibly Greece, possibly countries outside the EU, are going to refuse to pay, all of which will undermine the position of the British banking system.
Jenny, have you got any thoughts on the financial crisis then? I mean, we were talking about Iceland here specifically, but, you know, how do you think things are going to pan out? And what would you like to see the government here doing?
Well, we seem to be rushing headlessly into clearing every debt all at once without actually planning it, which I think there is no forethought in it. They haven't actually assessed that shutting down the quangos costs more money than keeping them going. Takes time, because they're having to pay redundancy pay. They're having to actually change buildings. They're having to keep some of the worst staff on their old wages, so they're not cutting their wages back because they can't.
Well, what is about this idea of the sort of the debt death spiral? As the debt gets, as the cuts kick in, the debt, or there's less tax coming in, and so the debt starts getting bigger, and it becomes eventually just absolutely massive and unserviceable.
It's going to get out of hand unless somebody looks at the economics that are being done by this government and to think very seriously about paying back slowly and steadily, which is what the Labour government wanted to do, rather than rushing in the deep end, which is what's happened now. And I don't know whether they live in a different world than us, but the people that are in Parliament don't seem to have any perspective on how this is ricocheting around the economy. Small businesses are in trouble. I mean, they're talking about thousands of them going to the wall very shortly. And it's all about the fact that they haven't got the money to pay the banks. So the banks are going to pick up yet another tab, and so are we, and so are ordinary people, by being made redundant and being out of work.
Well, you can't really blame the banks, though, can you? Because they don't want to lend to businesses at the moment, because they're worried the economy's going down, and if they lend money to these businesses, the businesses won't be able to pay it back.
Yes, but it might actually bail a few of them out so that they can pick themselves up and get back on their feet and start producing things. I mean, when I grew up, we made things in this country. I've got a brother that's in America. He's part of the brain drain. He has 22 patents out in Massachusetts listed on their web, because he invents things. We lost that generation. He's a scientist. There are scientists now today. There are many of them, after they qualify, they leave this country because we do not encourage them, and it's a lost generation. And my brother, sadly, is producing things for the American economy, whereas I would rather he had stayed in the UK and produced for ours.
Can I just chip in there? One of the other things that's happened in Britain is that people with science degrees, instead of going into what they've trained to do, whether it's chemistry or metallurgy or whatever, many of them have ended up in the City of London with their mathematical skills, inventing all this nonsense, which has actually crashed the economy. So you've got many of the people who design the collateralised debt obligations and structured investment vehicles are maths whizzes.
These are so-called derivatives, are they? The things that it's actually very difficult to put your finger on. When you reach out to touch it, it sort of slithers away.
Well, they're very, very clever at mathematically sophisticated things, but they're not actual products. They're just pieces of paper, very complicated pieces of paper. And the brain drain either goes to the US or other countries. Or the other thing is the City of London sucks in our best trained scientists. And instead of producing stuff, they're producing nonsense, which actually turns out to be wrong. Many of these people are scientists, but they're not economists. Economists could have told them, who are not so good at maths, that this is all wrong. But it doesn't matter, because they know that these things that have crashed the banking system are incredibly sophisticated mathematical instruments. There's only one thing wrong with them. They're just wrong. You can, it can be a very sophisticated mathematical instrument, but it's still wrong. The figures are wrong, the numbers are wrong. And that's what happens, because they presumed that everything was going to carry... All of these things are based on presumption. And, of course, a country like Iceland turns around and says it's not going to pay, and all the maths goes out of the window, however clever it is.
OK, from today's Guardian, cuts will force 250 Sure Start centres to close, say, charities. Now, you've brought this to my attention, Jenny. Do we have a Sure Start centre locally that may close?
We have 22 or 32. I can't get a clear figure.
For those that don't know, what are the Sure Start centres?
Sure Starts are a bit like nurseries, but they give support to mums and dads as well, and to children, and they are primarily aiming at the children that might come from families that are struggling to actually bring their children up. Sometimes it's one-parent families, sometimes it's people with no English background, and they also take other children alongside so that the balance is out the numbers. But it's about making sure that youngsters, by the time they get to school, have life skills that won't hold them back anymore.
So, is this going to affect any of the centres, or you have centres in your ward somewhere?
Well, what we've done in the city, if we'd lost £3 million out of that budget. And although the government are saying what they've done is put the whole of the budget for all children's services all into one pot, and that pot will not cover children in care. There's a little bit of extra money that's come to them, but it's early intervention grants were included. So the cuts, they put all the money together and then cut £3 million off of it, so that there will be some restructuring of some of the Sure Start places in the city, cut back in money, possibly loss of staff, as the article says is happening in Hampshire and other parts of the country. And let's be quite honest, this is our next generation of youngsters coming into this world. I want them to have a better life than I had, and every older person in our communities would be saying the same.
Well, I think Sure Start was one of the best initiatives of the Labour government. I mean, the war in Iraq probably the other extreme. What I would like to see as we break out of this depression, and we're only going to be able to do this with massive public expenditure, what we need is a whole new generation of state-of-the-art nursery schools which really give every child a flying start. And in places like Scandinavia, like Finland and Sweden, they've had those kind of nursery schools since the 1930s. Every child has a nursery place in Finland at the age of 3. They stay in nursery until they are 7. 4 years of learning through play, and it makes a huge difference to the quality of life in the society. Why can't we afford this? Because we'd rather run a free market banking run focused system, and that's the comparison for Britain shouldn't be with America. The comparison should be Norway and Finland. Why aren't we more like those countries?
Can I change and ask you to cover what's happened to our forests? Because I'm really concerned about this. I went to the Forester Dean on Saturday. I go to a grave there where my parents are. I visited my sister-in-law. It's the place where the family always goes when they want to have a relaxing and quiet time. But if it's privatised, we're extremely worried that things will change.
Well, what the government are talking about now is actually handing it over to a charity rather than privatising it to private individuals or companies.
Well, I can't see how that will save money, because at the moment anybody that owns a bit of private forest gets subsidised by the government already. Certainly the millionaires that wrote to the Times saying we would like to have the forests, well, they've had vested interests, because they're looking at their future of how to not have capital gains tax levied against them, and how not to pay tax on any of the wooden logs.
Yeah, but surely it doesn't actually matter who owns it. I mean, so long as you've got access to walk through it, that's the main thing, isn't it?
No, it isn't. It's about people feeling they own a little bit of this country, and we always have felt that the right to roam was there, The nature reserves are there. It's places we take youngsters to teach them. It's about valuing an inheritance that belongs to everybody.
But surely a charity could look after it just as well, possibly even better than the government do, through the Forestry Commission.
Well, I actually think the Forestry Commission, at least, if they get it wrong, we and the government of the time can actually slap their knuckles and say, this is not what you should be doing. Whereas a charity is out on a limb, and individuals can change time, and also it makes it vulnerable if they run out of money to actually sell it off.
Now, Martin, I know you're someone that likes on a nice sunny day to be out strolling in the countryside wherever possible. So what are your thoughts on the forest privatisation?
Well, I think I agree with Jenny. I mean, the vested interests that want the vultures that are hanging around for the pickings from this. I mean, this is the forestry is almost like everything else that's going on, because the banks have crashed and they're still insolvent. By the way, they're not actually profitable, no matter what they say. We've now got to sell off everything that's not nailed down, including the forests. And of course, these vultures are the people who are going to buy it up.
But this is going to help pay off the deficit,
no,
don't you see?
No, it's not going to help pay off the deficit, as Jenny points out. If we're going to give it to charities and third sector organisations, then there's no money to be made. And if we're selling it to the private sector, they will want to make money out of it, won't they? The private sector is not a charity.
Well, they maybe will just see these forests as an investment and keep them as they are.
No, they will see them as an investment because they get lots of tax breaks on them. The tax breaks on private forests are a scandal, actually. They should be abolished. It's a way that wealthy landowners rip off the taxpayer yet again after they've had their EU subsidies and all the other subsidies that they get. I mean, many people in rural Britain don't realise that you are on the dole. A lot of what we call agriculture in this country is subsidised by the taxpayer. If we were going to have a free market, we'd buy all of our meat from Argentina and all of our bread from Canada. But we don't have a free market, we subsidise you. But you don't realise you're subsidised because you've got your children in private school and you drive a 4x4, so you're not subsidised, you're not on a handout. Yes, you are, you're on a handout.
Can I give a quote from a letter in The Guardian? First they sold the family silver, then they've sold the furniture, and now they're trying to take the National Garden away from us. And that sums up what's happening with our forests.
That's from Harold Macmillan's original quote, isn't it? It's Harold Macmillan's original quote about the family silver being sold off because he was criticising Margaret Thatcher with her privatisation policy. Because in the past, Conservatives understood the value of national production, national industries. It wasn't controversial. Privatisation was opposed by many Conservatives in the 1950s and 1960s. They believed in things owned by the people.
Well, things have moved on.
What's happened to them?
Things have moved on since
now,
then.
Now, you haven't asked me about the health service.
Go on then.
And it's another area that so many of us are really concerned about. At the moment, the government have rushed through all sorts of policy changes. First one they did, right the very moment they got elected, was decide that all community hospitals would be handed to the private sector. That slid through without being in this bill and without majority of people knowing about it. I'm asking whether a new community hospital in Southmead Hospital is going to be handed over, and the one in South Bristol, because they're both community hospitals. But they've done away with primary health trusts and regional health authorities, and they're to be abolished. And GP consortiums will be forced to become the gatekeepers for the NHS with control of 80% of the budget. GPs are not employed by the NHS. They're private contractors for the NHS. And I don't think people realise that.
Well, we're going to have a whole load of probably something like 20, 25 minutes of all about the NHS after the 6 o'clock news. So is there anything finally you want to say about it now, Jenny?
Well, can I quote Nye Bevan?
Go on.
Because I think your listeners have got to think about this.
So who was Nye Bevan, first of all?
Nye Bevan was the founder of the National Health Service. He was the minister that achieved it, despite the privatised doctors fighting him. And he really fought tooth and nail to get us the health service we've got in this country. And he said, it will last as long as there are folk left with the faith to fight for it. So I think people have got to decide whether they are going to demand that we keep the NHS in this country.
Now, on to another story. And David Cameron was challenged to explain why he held a secret dinner with James Murdoch as the government prepared to take a crucial decision on the Murdoch media empire in its monopoly. This is also combined with last week's sacking of David Cameron's spin doctor, Andy Coulson, from the News of the World, and the increasing phone hacking scandal. So now, let's have a listen to one of the News of the World reporters who was on a Newsnight report a couple of nights ago, and it's actually Richard Watson's report, and the chap who's speaking is former News of the World reporter Paul McMullen.
A former News of the World journalist told us that controversial tactics were widespread.
People used to go round, you know, all the record companies' bins and empty the bins and look for people's information. That was kind of accepted, and that was a grey area. So at the same time, if people were ringing up celebrities' phones and hitting nine and trying to get into their default messages, that was perfectly fine by me. You know, I did it myself, and I know so many people that did it. It's almost second nature, it was.
As the evidence is picked through, there'll be uncomfortable days ahead for News International's proprietor, Rupert Murdoch, and his son, James. Former News of the World journalist expected a call from the police, which duly arrived.
And they rang me up three times, and the third time is that I'm sitting here in Canterbury, you want to come, you want to talk to me, then I'll see you later. And they didn't. They said they simply could not be bothered to drive from London to Canterbury to speak to me, and instead they just crossed me off the list. I knew it wasn't a real investigation anyways. I knew they wanted to find no evidence.
He has a controversial theory for a motive.
A lot of police were being paid by journalists, and more so in the late 90s and early 2000s when, you know, going rate for a number plate was 200 quid. And a lot of police made a nice little sideline by, you know, selling snippets of information to journalists. I mean, I bought a few nice choice snippets myself. And if you've got, you know, 30% of the Met making a nice little living off the back of tabloid journalists, I mean, you're surely not going to want to open that can of worms.
So that was Paul McMullen from the News of the World talking about paying £200 for a number plate from the police. Do you think this is one of the reasons, Martin, that maybe that the police were a bit slow to investigate these 3,000, apparently, potential phone hackings that went on? And the police did have a list of all the people who had been listened to by this private investigator, that there was a bit of a too cosy relationship between the police in London and the News of the World?
I think that's quite clearly the case. The police have used the News of the World over the years as a means of basically leaking things that they wanted to come out about various people and about various investigations they were engaged in, and the relationship has become far too incestuous. And if they are going to investigate now and they do discover that the News of the World has been phone hacking, as presumably they have been, if police officers are implicated in that, they should be prosecuted, not just the journalists.
Well, there's also one of the editors at the News of the World was sacked this week, so it's really quite clear that there is an admission at the News of the World that this was something which wasn't just individual reporters.
And do we want these people to be running even more of our media than they are already? I think the answer is no.
Yes, well, it's come at a bit of a bad time for Rupert Murdoch since he's trying to get the Competition Commission to allow him to take over the whole of Sky. What do you think this teaches us, Jenny, if anything, about the way our media works in this country?
I think we must value our media, but make it as diverse as possible, because at the moment it's controlling the opinions of many people in this country who are not actually challenging themselves to think about what's really happening in the world and right under their very noses. I'm raising things like the forestry, I'm raising the NHS service, Sure Start, all the things that affect everyday life. How often do you really see this coming up in the papers in depth? Usually one or two lines and that's it. No, we need to know, because this is our country and our world and we live in it.
What about Bristol and the regional media that's based here? Because we're a bit of a media hub outside London, aren't we?
Well, I haven't noticed that too much, because lots of the media I don't meet. Partly because I have made sure I don't, because perhaps I'm too close to ordinary people's lives and I'm really worried sometimes that I will say something that I shouldn't do about an individual in our community. But the media here the Evening Post, to me, seems to be unbalanced, although it's been doing quite well on green parks at the moment. I would congratulate it.
Okay. Now we're joined by Marina Morris, who has a report for us about food and food security and related matters. Hi, Marina.
Hello. A government-commissioned report from a two-year study involving 400 experts from 35 countries was published this week. Scientists are warning the government that the current food production system is unsustainable and will fail to end world hunger unless radically redesigned. Some of the reasons why future food production is expected to be inadequate are the growth of the human population, currently approaching 7 billion, forecast to reach 8 billion by 2030 and 9 billion by 2050. Demand for better and more varied food as well increases. Increasing competition for land, water and energy, adapting to climate change and globalization. The report identifies that we can't think about food, climate change or energy in isolation. They are intimately related. It also calls for protection of the poorest from sharp price rises through government intervention and greater liberalization of the trade in food, implying that policies such as European Union Common Agriculture Policy are damaging agriculture in the developing world. Scientists advise that nearly a billion people in the world experience hunger. There's a further billion having a diet missing key nutrients or vitamins, and the other extremely a further billion people substantially overeat. Future food production will be limited by degrading ecosystems, erosion of soils, overfishing, over-extraction of groundwater, and a heavy unsustainable dependence on fossil fuels. The report discussed the potential advantages of genetic modification technology. The Soil Association, who broadly supports the report, says that despite billions being pumped into genetic modification, it has failed to deliver against its promises. The future of world agriculture is small, local, of organic farmers, which is better for environment, better for animal and human welfare, and offers more resilience to issues such as rise in oil and fertilizer price. There is perhaps nothing more political than starvation and hunger. This issue will not go away. Scientists are warning the government that the global food production system is unsustainable. Does a food shortage problem exist?
I would say no. Personally, myself, I know we've got butter mountains, we've got sugar mountains, we've got oodles of stuff packed away that they don't bring out. So I can't see how we can have a food shortage, basically. And to be perfectly honest, with all the genetically improved farming and food, I can't see it being a problem.
Yes, I think there is a food shortage problem. Not necessarily where we are in the UK, but certainly worldwide there is, and in the poorer parts of the world, certainly there's a food shortage which needs to be addressed.
I don't know, really, because I only go by what the experts tell me. But then again, there's food somewhere in like these sort of developing nations. They got in warehouses and it's not distributed to people who need it. Sometimes they hide the problem.
I'm not aware that there is a food shortage problem, to be honest with you. It's just mass production of food. I mean, especially in the Western world, we seem to have like an abundance of food, don't we?
It's up to everybody themselves to do their own thing, grow their own food, basically. Stop, you know, doing chemicals.
What food problems can you foresee and what can we do about it?
But I can't see a problem. Maybe they need to, I don't say it's probably callous, is to cut down the population as an example. And I don't want this to sound racist, because it's not. And we keep sending aid, food, we keep sending aid, money, food, and everything to all these so-called third world countries who are having babies by the millions and they can't feed them. Maybe we should be addressing that problem as opposed to the food, because we need to educate these people that maybe only have two babies, not 10. Two have got more chance of survival. Again, maybe get rid of all the junk food people that are making people obese, and educating people to eat, obviously, to eat the right, it's not just the right food, but the right amount. You see so many obese people, and all they're doing is stuffing themselves with chips and burgers and cakes and knows what. it's all the wrong food anyway. The more obese they become, the more they want to eat. So you've got to educate the people, but to eat smaller portions. You don't need these huge portions.
Well, there are parts of Africa and India, places like that, which we always think of as being deserts and not producing. There are areas there which can be better used to feed their populations, and people can be educated as to growing more food. We should take steps to reduce the amount of the population, reduce the growth in the population to try and meet a balance.
Well, what's the population of the world? 6 billion? 9 billion? Well, yeah, there will be problems, I suppose. Then, if people start fighting over food, there could be another war, I suppose. And then that way, population will go right down and people will be killing each other for food. It seems to me that in some countries, they give food aid to wherever, Asia, Africa. As far as I can see, they don't seem to help themselves. They just wait for aid to come along, and they could go and help themselves and grow crops and things like that and food. There's countries like Israel where they got everything's irrigated, and that could be done for those kind of countries in Africa. And they say about floods. Well, if they have preparations if they know they're going to get floods every few years, they could have dams and they can sort of divert the water to areas where they need it, like build massive pipelines throughout Africa for irrigation of crops.
Should we grow more of our own food in gardens and allotments?
Yes, because we used to do it. And the sad thing is, as well, I mean, there are organic farms. Because they're organic and there's no pesticides and chemicals put on the food, the food tastes a lot better, like it used to 20 years ago, people put a higher price on it. By putting a higher price on it, people can't afford it. So really, we should go back to the way we were before and used to grow our own vegetables in the back garden or a little plot or whatever. And you can help that way. And you've got organic food, but without the organic prices.
Yes, I have a vegetable patch in my own garden. I'm not sure that actually helps with the global problem, but it helps feed me and keep my food prices down.
Well, I used to. Don't tend to do it, and I wonder if it's really economical to grow your own, what you've got to use to stop all the pests getting at it, and where you can go to the supermarket and buy it cheaper. It's good for you, yeah, if you grow your own, yeah.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I think that's a good idea. Well, I think it's better for you, for a start. I mean, it's fresher, probably organic, which I think is got to be better for everyone. So, and it's cheaper as well, isn't it? So definitely.
No, I don't, but I do look out. I do. I'm very concerned about this. I don't shop in supermarkets. No way. It's all chemicals. Simple. They're the ones telling us what to do in this world.
That was you and your views on the food security, and also looking at whether it's a good idea to grow your own food here in the city. Now, Jenny, do you think Jenny Smith, Labour councillor for South Mead, do you think the provision in the city is good for allotments? I know places like St Werburgh's and the Muller Road site are known around the country as a fantastic allotment. Do you think we've got enough facilities for people to grow their own food here?
I think people should be encouraged to grow their own food. I do. I've got apple trees, plum trees, gooseberry bushes, black currant, white currant and red currant bushes. I grow a lot of my own fruit. Brussels sprouts, they're sitting in the garden at the moment, ready for us to eat. Spinach, things I can grow so that I can eat fresh food as much as possible. But at the same time, we're affected, aren't we, by what's happening globally. Australia's now flooded. That's taken an awful lot of their crops. They're going to be buying up food to subsidise for what's underwater at the moment. Russia have had major fires go through, and that was the grain crops of the world. Food is going to cost a lot more than it used to do, and it will pay people in this city to actually have a plot of land and to grow their own food. It won't cover it all, but it at least takes the edge off some of the price rises.
Yeah, a lot of the price rises we're seeing in the food markets are because of the deregulation of commodity futures markets a few years ago. It's the same story as the banks. There used to be very strong regulations on buying futures in things like pork bellies or wheat, and it was all got rid of. So now you've got speculators buying up food products, but not actually buying physical products. They're just buying a futures option on those products, and that's forcing up the price of food. And the bankers are going into the commodity markets because they can't make money in the mainstream market. And that means that bankers are profiting directly from the creation of hunger and starvation in developing countries. And of course, the kickback from that, as we've seen in Tunisia and Egypt and in Yemen, is when people haven't got enough to eat, eventually something snaps and they start to fight. I mean, one of the people talking there about people fighting about food, that is one of the things that is definitely already happening. There is actually enough food in the world to feed everybody. There always has been. It's not a question of production. We've got all the technology we need to feed ourselves. The problem is distribution. Poor people cannot afford to eat properly. We need to address that.
But surely a big part of this is the massive growth in population of the planet.
There is an issue there. People brought up the issue of population there, but every single person in a developed country like Britain uses far, far more resources than an individual person in a country like Sudan. And in actual fact, if we wanted to solve the problem, we've got to actually look at the resource use of the wealthy people. And I mean the really wealthy people who waste money. And of course, particularly looking at the commodities markets, they should never have been deregulated a few years ago. We've now got an absurd situation where bankers are bidding up the price of food to make profits while people are starving. Totally unacceptable.
I accept that. But at the same time, I think that the climate changes that are going throughout the world is affecting the ability of many countries to produce the crops that they did in the past.
And let's not forget, as Marina said in her report, that we've got 1 billion people on this planet, 1,000 million, who are overeating.
Well, that's true. I mean, so we've got an absurd situation where some overeat and others don't eat enough. Also, when people are talking about food aid in general is a bad idea because it destroys the local production in the local countries. But you know why there's a massive food aid? Because the US subsidises its own production, doesn't know what to do with it, and then gives it away as bribes to to friendly countries like Tunisia. Egyptians eat they eat bread made with wheat given to them by the United States, but the United States is not giving them out of the goodness of their heart. They've got overproduction because they subsidise their own production, and then they use it to try and bribe countries to do what they want. So Egypt, for example, lined up with the so-called allies during the Iraq war, not because the Egyptian people supported the war, they massively opposed it, but they were told, if you do not support us in this, we will cut off your food supply. And there's been a long-run policy by the US to control the world food markets for political reasons, and that is, it's absolutely immoral, it's completely wrong, and it's now leading to those who sow the wind reap the whirlwind, and they're reaping the whirlwind now in the Arab world.
Well, coming back bang down to earth here in the city, and Bristol's former Bristol City Council homeless centre, The Hub on Cumberland Street, which is just around the corner from the Bear Pit, have taken up residence in the building. Squatters have taken over what was The Hub. We covered this story a couple of weeks ago. But this weekend, they're opening for the first time on Saturday, Sunday and Monday from 12 till 6 p.m. And anyone is welcome for advice, support, a cup of tea and some free food if you're needing homelessness advice. Now, first of all, before we hear from Anna, who's one of the squatters there, who's opening the former Bristol City Council Homeless Advice Centre as a squatters homeless advice centre, what are your thoughts about the provision in the city at the moment, Jenny, for homelessness?
Well, I think that most people don't know where to go if they are homeless. I raised this matter on the Housing Management Committee, which I am a member, and the City Council, and the two Liberal Democrats that were there actually said that they'd shut The Hub because they were doing preventative work to be able to get people before they became homeless, not after. Now, clearly someone's homeless if they're squatting it. So they've missed some.
Well, I know we have something like...
Worrying is how many more are out there that are homeless that aren't getting the service or being able to access the service.
Well, the housing list, it used to be a list of film you filled in and you went onto the list if you were homeless in one way or another. Maybe, for example, you're sleeping on someone's sofa. You do actually have somewhere to stay for the time being, but you're officially homeless. And then you were offered places based on points if you were on the list. So it's very easy to tell how many people were on the list. Now we have this thing called choice-based lettings, which is one of those rather nasty spun terms where you have to literally every week bid for somewhere. And at the time that that it went over from the old system to the new system, there were nearly 20,000 people on the old housing list. Now, I don't know how these Liberal Democrats have managed to... Next time we get Anthony Negus in here, we must ask him how he's managed to get zero homeless people from 18,000 in such a short space of time. Anyway, now let's go over to...
I asked Negus about this, and I pointed out that nationally in the last quarter there'd been a 70% rise in homelessness across the country, and I was assured that they didn't have the same problem in Bristol. Now, I know as an old shelter worker that people don't always present themselves completely on the street. They live in garages, they go into squats, they go anywhere, different friends, settees, not the sort of life that can really settle someone down and give them a chance to go back to a normal living.
Well, let's go over now to the former Bristol Homeless Advice Centre in Cumberland Street, near the Bear Pit, and hear from Anna.
Well, my name is Anne. I live here at what used to be the Hub drop-in centre for homeless people, and it is being reopened as such by us, the occupants, this Saturday. We are in 13 to 17 Cumberland Street.
Don't you think it's a little bit cheeky to take over, for squatters to take over a homeless centre that used to be run by the council?
Well, you could say it's a bit cheeky to take away vital services from people who actually sleep on the streets and have nowhere to go. And as we are these people, we've decided to take back these services.
So what sort of service will you be able to provide if people drop in who are homeless or think they may be made homeless soon?
First thing, I should say what we are not able to provide, unfortunately, which is sleeping spaces for people. We can, however, if you are in a housing emergency situation, point you towards various places in the city where you can find help. We can also help you if you are threatened with eviction, if you have legal issues, if you're getting your home repossessed, we can discuss various options that you have, and also we can give you advice on channels that you can go through that are not the official ones provided by the city.
You're not from Bristol yourself, I can tell from your accent, so are you one of the people the Daily Mail has been talking about who comes over to Britain because the benefit system here is so much better than in Austria?
I'm not, actually, and that assumption is a bit ridiculous, because Austria, where I'm coming from, has a very good social system. I could easily get three times as much benefit there as I could get here. I'm not getting any benefit here, I should add, so in case the taxpayer is worried. But I'm here because I think that in this country there is a great need, more than in other countries, for people to self-organise and provide services that the state doesn't.
That's Anna there from the former Hub, and it's now been squatted, and it's open Saturday, Sunday, that's tomorrow, Sunday and Monday from 12 till 6 for homeless advice for anyone that has maybe been to the Bristol City Council's official homeless place and found that they haven't actually got anywhere to live. Martin, just can you just put this in context, the whole squatting thing?
Well, I think it's quite interesting because, of course, as the government supposedly withdraws from providing services, that the big society is supposed to take over. And there we have a situation here where the big society has taken over. Squatters have taken over what used to be a local council facility. And we're going to see even more of the big society on the streets tomorrow as people demonstrate about education cuts in London and Manchester, and on the streets of Bristol on Sunday when people will be trying to close down non-tax-paying department stores in central Bristol. People are assembling at 1 p.m. on Castle Green on Sunday. The big society is going to jump up and bite the government in the bum. It's already beginning.
Okay, thank you, Martin. Now, for our final story, last week at this time over in Dublin, guests and television crews were limbering up for Irish broadcaster RTE's flagship weekly live TV programme. Ireland's Late Late Show has an audience of about 1 million viewers, and last Friday night, musician and political activist Jim Corr shocked audiences by, in the midst of the country's financial and political turmoil, challenging the official version of the 9/11 attacks.
Would you welcome, please, the musician and activist Jim Corr. Now, of course, everyone will know you, first and foremost, as a member of the Corps, successful musician and so forth. But in recent times, you've held what some might be considered to be alternative views on world events, if you like. The initial interest in taking this slant on the world came from what? Was there a trigger for it?
Well, it was 9/11, and okay. I got very curious as to what actually happened that day, and I had a lot of questions, and as I began to study it and kept at it, and I discovered that there was just so many anomalies,
yeah.
that were, it was obvious to me that the official story just could not be true. And I continued on. Well, recently we've had a group of architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, over 1,100 of them, state that those buildings could not have come down the way that we were told.
OK, and we'll have Martin's reply after the news.
On BCFM 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol.